Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Yeah, there it is. When that robot voice pops in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to ELC. Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, Maybe you've been swimming all day. Maybe you're baked from the sunshine. Maybe you're trying to wipe that sunblock off your forehead and all you want is some friends in your ear holes. Well, we're going to be there for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. They bring the show to you. Their support, their generosity means we get to make this here podcast, and boy, are we grateful. In exchange, those patrons get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a bunch of bonus content. We've got spoiler chats available. We have, ladies and gentlemen, a show called Feeling This, in which Alex Solman and Christian Spicer talk about the feelings behind video games. So much fun. People love it. Season 3, right around the corner, starts in July. It's July if you're hearing this. Starts a little later in July, but it's coming soon. You want to be a patron for that. Also, we've got the paid DLC program. It's our Wednesday bonus show where Lana Bashinsky joins Christian Spicer and myself to talk about all kinds of wacky topics as prescribed by our patrons, weaving in what they think about stuff. It's so much fun. All of it available by supporting the show at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am usually joined by the illustrious Christian Spicer. But this week, he's got better things to do. I'm told Christian has a loving family that enjoys spending time with him. It's not a sensation I'm aware of. I'm familiar with, I should say. No, he's having a great time. I think he's gone on vacation or doing something fun with the fam. So he's not here. But ladies and gentlemen, we have an awesome replacement in chair two this week. Our friend, art director at BitReactor, which is currently working on a AAA Star Wars title that is only halfway announced. It's Danish Syed. Hey, Danish, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. It's been a while. It's good to be here.
It has. You've popped up on the paid DLC show and every now and again over the last, several months. And it's always fun having you there. But hey, it's great having you back on the main show. I miss talking about this stuff with you. And we can't really talk about your game, although one detail has been announced, the genre of Star Wars game that it's going to be, right?
Yeah, it's still really early, but we are making a tactical strategy game, so that's out there.
Ooh,
now.
I love me tactical strategy games. You know that. I like a turn-based. I don't know anything about anything, but I'm saying I like tactics and I like strategies. So I'm very excited about that. But you're going to be joining us to talk about all the stuff we usually talk about in second chair. But ladies and gentlemen, we have an awesome third chair as well. You know the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata. This week it also stands for your Danish loadable commentary. But because we have a guest, I'm so excited the DLC also stands for Decidedly Livelier Conference. because we have the co-host of the one conference call you actually look forward to, the Gamers with Jobs conference call podcast. Our friend Rich Lovejoy is back with us. Hey, Rich, how are you?
I am good. I am also excited because podcasting is turn-based, much like my favorite types of tactical strategy games. So, yeah.
I mean, I guess most. I guess if you're good at it, it is. If not, it's just a real-time free-for-all. You know,
real-time pause is a rough way to do podcasting. It's really tough on the editors.
Real-time combat. You know what I'm saying? That's not the way we do things here. We try to be respectful. I gotta say, I'm really excited this week, slash terrified, because I don't think I could pick two people in the world that are worse for my wallet than you guys. Every time I talk to the two of you, I'm finding out something that I was not aware of that I then run out and purchase. I bought a bunch of board games last time Rich was on. Danish is always there's like several things that I'll talk about in the show that I bought because of Danish. It's going to be a bloodbath for me financially this week.
Let's take him down.
Yeah, just go ahead and preload your Steam wallet with some money right now. Jeff, there's one. You've got at least one on my list. I'm going to tell you, you're going to buy it before this
all
is
right,
done.
Well, just there's anybody to it. Anybody listening that wants to become a patron this week, I could use it. I could use the extra scratch. All right, let's jump in and start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That's also where you can send comments, questions, anything you'd like us to know. We love hearing from folks at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But email is not the only way to get a hold of us, to participate in the community, to talk amongst yourselves. We also have a Discord, a fun place where folks can hang out and talk about the show, video games, anything you want. It is at 5x5 DLC on Discord, and there's a great community there. I urge you to take part. But Rich, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Well, I think I am going to lean away from all the awful news that might actually technically be a story of the week, and instead lean into some, I guess, semi not great news, but still worth.
That's the best
about.
We can get these days. Yeah. In this, the year of our Lord 2024, that's the best we can do is the not awful news.
Yeah, we're not going to kick you in the face, but we are going to stub your toe a little bit with this Fidelity Death Cult article from Rock Paper Shotgun. This was a story apparently sent in by John Atchley.
Yeah,
and it's about a video from a former Dragon Age executive producer, Mark Dara, who basically kind of unpacks some of the reasons why AAA games take as long as they do to come out. And I'm not a developer, so this type of like kind of behind the curtain stuff is always interesting to me. But one of the big things that that Mark talks about is the Fidelity Death Cult, which means it takes a lot of time and energy and resources to create something that is extremely close to looking like real life. And so, like, you know, you have individually animated hair strands on characters. That's going to eat a lot of your development time that could be put in other places or towards different objectives. And I just think this is fascinating because I'm somebody who tends to not go bananas for really hyper-realistic graphics. I'm always more interested in something that is stylized smartly, that's making an interesting choice with graphics that open the game up to other things. So it's interesting to see somebody in the industry kind of talk about like how much time is actually spent on these things that at the end of the day, how much what are you getting for the amount of time and energy you're putting into that? I mean, obviously some of these games look really impressive, but then there are also games that don't that didn't put all their time to high visual fidelity. And I think one of the examples he cites is Baldur's Gate 3, where they put their time and their development time and energy into other places, and you know, that the way, the different ways that the AA space and the indie space can kind of get out of kind of ruts and make kind of riskier decisions, or decisions that sound riskier on paper but might actually be better. So yeah, I thought this was a really interesting video. It's about 25 minutes. It's a really simple listen, and I definitely think it's worth people checking out.
I agree. Thanks to John for sending this in. Again, John sent this story to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. And I'm glad he did, because I was not aware of Mark Dara's YouTube channel, which he's been doing evidently for a while now. Mark was one of the higher level execs at BioWare for a long time, was involved in a lot of really big BioWare titles, the Mass Effects, the Dragon Ages. He was one of the top producers on Dragon Age, a couple of the Dragon Ages. Worked on Jade Empire, worked on even Anthem, but has left the company. And so I think this is what he's doing, is kind of doing this YouTube channel, which is awesome, because he gives a lot of really interesting insights like the ones in this video. But there's also a lot of really interesting stuff just about being a manager of people on his YouTube page, which I thought was really fascinating too. And he's kind of talking about video games, but also, you know, sort of corporate structure and working as an executive. And there's a lot of really interesting information. Highly recommend checking out his channel, Mark Dara, D-A-R-R-A-H. But yeah, I mean, I think this is, you summarized it very well, Rich, that he goes into a lot of reasons. The name of the video is "Why Do Video Games Take So Long to Make?" And he talks about a variety of reasons. The first of the reasons he talks about is they don't, actually, which I thought was great. but he does, you know, go into a lot of other reasons why, you know, times have extended. And I think John was very much interested in this one. And I do think this is one of the most interesting points that Mark makes in his video, is this term that he coins, the fidelity death cult. Just so happens we have a developer on the show this week with us who has been involved in some very high fidelity games in the past, Mortal Kombat.
And some death cults is my
understanding. Maybe, I don't know. I don't want to
talk about that later.
Assume. Oh, yeah, maybe we'll save that for off mic.
you know, Jedi Survivor, Danish worked on. And so these are very high fidelity franchises, very high fidelity games. And I'm curious if you have any insight into what Mark Dara is talking about.
Well, I will say I didn't have a chance to watch the video, but I did read the write-up on Rock Paper Shotgun, and knowing I was going to be on and talking about this, I felt so many mixed emotions. Like, I kind of don't know how to respond to this, because there's lots of really pertinent like points being made here, but also there's some things I don't know if I completely agree with, that that realism takes longer. I think it's fidelity of any kind takes longer. Like, you can make extremely high fidelity stylized games, and that will also take very long. So I'm not exactly sure about that distinction. And again, maybe if I watch the video, I can kind of get what he's saying a little bit clearer. But to me, like, where do we begin? There's so many complicated issues with why games take so long. It's technical, it's design, it's art direction, it's everything. Everything has it's sort of like finding the right proportions of everything. I think this article kind of touches on a little bit of like, you know, where do you put your resources? You have a certain amount of time, a certain amount of, you know, bandwidth, and what is your focus of the game? Is it going to be photorealistic? You know, we just saw Hellblade 2, which is like an absolutely stunning game, and I don't know what the cost of making a game like that would be if it was open world, for example. I mean, I guess we kind of do with GTA, right? That's like a very high fidelity game, and those games take a very long time to make. So it really is allocating resources and like determining what is the most important thing about this game. What does this game need? we're going to be talking about a game later that that I'm going to mention now, Still Wakes the Deep, which if you think about a game like that, a first-person narrative game, then where you put your resources is in the immersive nature of it, the fidelity of the facial animation and voice acting. And because what you're doing is telling the story. Whereas if the focus of the game is something else, like an arcade beat 'em up or a shmup or something like that, like it's different. So I don't know. I feel like I'm hesitant to make any kind of broad proclamations about how things are because it's so dependent on what you're trying to do.
Mm. Well, one of the points that he makes in the video is that player expectation has sort of shifted. I mean, this Mark Dara is a guy who started working in AAA game development in the 90s, in the late 90s. And so, you know, he's been working through, you know, eras of you know, seeing the industry evolve and shift. And one of the things he was mentioning is that these days players have an expectation, especially when you're playing in a realm of high fidelity of, you know, trying to think, make things look better and better. And that in his view, developers can get sidetracked in pleasing this this sort of lust for the expectations that players have, that thing where, oh, you reused some assets, and you know, and mm-hmm. he said in you know earlier eras you reused assets, yeah. and everybody knew that's what you were going to do, and you built, you know, this level out of the stuff that you built the two levels ago out of, and that's just the way it was. And that players kind of will, you know, chide developers for that, and developers are hypersensitive to it, mm-hmm. and so it becomes this kind of weird feedback loop that doesn't actually make the game any better, but it soaks up a lot of time and energy. Is that something that resonates with you, or what is your feeling about that point?
That's an interesting question, because this actually does come up where I was working on fighting games for over 10 years, and we absolutely reused certain animations. And I don't know if we were ever called out for it, because if you look at Street Fighter, like, you want Ryu to look like Ryu and move like Ryu. And, right. and some of specific punches and, you know, dragon uppercuts or whatever it is, like, it has to look a certain way, and that's what makes him him. And so I think there's a gray area there for some games where it's almost expected. Yeah, that kind of backlash, I honestly don't know if I've seen a lot of developers that I've worked with kind of be too precious about that. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't really have a great take on it, because I've kind of seen it both ways.
Rich, you know, one of the things that Mark talks about also is this shift that we've seen in the last, I don't know, decade, I guess, toward forever games, as he calls them in the video. You know, these live service yeah. games is another term, or, you know, games that the marketing people say will sell more copies because people perceive them as being higher value for their dollar, where, you know, you games like Destiny 2 and large MMOs, or just big games like Skyrim or Elden Ring, games that players perceive they can play for much, much longer than maybe games in the past used to be. And they're designed that way, and therefore sort of require a lot more content to be stuffed in, and therefore more time to make. That's something that I've talked about a lot on this show about, you know, as somebody who's also lived through a lot of a lot of time playing games. I don't necessarily think that is a positive trend. I'm wondering what your perception of that point was.
Well, I think that is something of a hangover in our culture from trying to create product from art or commodify a thing, and then think about it in terms of like quantity instead of how long does a thing actually need to be. Just a little teaser into some of the games that I'm playing later. It's actually such a breath of fresh air, and I think a lot of people are feeling this now, when you have a game that is, you know, even if it's a big meaty RPG, let's say, actually, you know, you could finish it in about as much time as you maybe clock in to work in a week. Instead of you know, being lost in a thing forever. And I think you know, obviously there have been some some live service forever games that have really hit hard recently. But I also think that in general, we've started to see the diminishing returns on that. People, you know, that I don't think everybody wants that. I think a lot of people want, you know, people have different things that they want, and games are better when they are the size and length that they should be, whether or not, you know, they're the gaming equivalent of the film Magnolia, or whether or not they're like the gaming equivalent of a short film. And I think that there's a right, what's right for one game is not going to be right for another. And a game can be extremely, it can deliver a lot of value, even if it's really expensive and only an hour long. Like there's, yeah. You can have some moving things. I'll point to like very recently, Indica released, it's maybe a 4 or 5 hour game. It's terrific. It's not expensive. That one, not don't mean to imply that at all. That one's very reasonably priced game, but also like terrific. It gets in, it does its thing, it makes its point, it gets out. And I think that there's going to be increased appetite for that over time. So I find it interesting that he is mentioning that there's still this pressure for live service things, because I kind of wonder if that might have diminished somewhat.
Well, it's interesting. Just this week, I saw a report citing the fact that Helldivers 2 has lost reportedly 90% of its player base. And the report I saw was with no hope of getting them back, to which I would say, like, that game was a smash hit, right? That's a smash. That is, by any metric, you did it. Like, the fact that you're now, oh, you're losing 90% of your game. It's like, well, you know what else lost 100% of its audience? Every movie that's ever screened, you know, like they saw it, yeah. They walked out, they had a positive experience, they were happy for the rest of the day, you know, the best movies. So it's like the expectation being that, oh, all the, you know, the millions of people that were playing Helldivers 2 that short period of time aren't still playing it 6, 8, 12 months later. That's somehow a failure. And it's like, well, I think we've kind of got our priorities a little mixed. I mean, I'm certain anybody making anything wants people to love it forever and ever and play it forever and ever. But realistically, like, you know, the entire history of video games is you buy the video game, you play the video game, you can be done with the video game. You don't have to keep playing it for it to not be a failure. You know,
the thing that there's a term, like people call it, oh, it's a dead game. It's dead game now. Like,
yeah.
That has always really annoyed me, because it's like that was the default.
Right.
That to me, that still is the default. Like,
yes,
the game's dead now. Yeah. Well, that's how it works. Like, that's
yeah. Like,
the opposite, like, is the weird thing.
That movie is dead now. No, I just finished watching the movie. I watched the whole movie. I got all the joy. I mean, you're the person that coined the term that we use on the show, danishing a game, where it's like, I got what I wanted out of that thing, and now I'm moving on to another thing. It's a weird new phenomenon, I think, that it has to be this enduring, you know, 10, 15, 20 year thing in order for it to be deemed successful. That's just wild to me.
Well, it's also that, like, it's, you know, studios, publishers, they see dollar signs in it. And that's really where it comes from. It's like, wow, if we can have a game that prints money like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I mean, it I don't know if I want to call it a trend, because it's here to stay. It's not going to go anywhere, but it takes a lot to do it. You have to it takes a lot of know-how to do it. It takes a lot of experience, and it's really, really difficult, and not everybody can do it, but you know, publishers want to try, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem is that there are those games, right? There are the Grand Theft Autos of the world, the, you know, the Worlds of Warcraft, the, you know, Destiny 2s. There are those games that stick around. Minecraft. It's hard to set out and go, well, I'm not even shooting for that. But it's like, I'm sure some of those games did shoot for that, but I think some of them just didn't, and it just happened. You know, I mean, I don't think they made Grand Theft Auto thinking they were gonna, you know, people were gonna be playing Grand Theft Auto 5. 10 years later, but I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think people crave novelty. And when it comes to games or kind of any kind of creative expression, I think what people ultimately want, or when people are happiest, is when there's like a diverse set of things that they can engage with, and you kind of get a healthy, balanced, like, you know, get to enjoy the creative work of other people, think about your own and your whatever your own practice might be in creativity and finding ways to express yourself. I think that's like where we want to gravitate towards. It's just, it's yeah, it's hard sometimes, and it's easy to, I think that's really astute that, you know, publishers will see the dollar sign and think that could be me. They'll look at the Helldivers too and be like, I could be the space bug forever game. But the truth is, like, really, you know, maybe just find a good idea that's worth doing with people who are excited about it and put it out there, and you'll find a community of people who are excited about it, and your game will live forever because people will think about it and they'll look back fondly on it. And there's more to playing a game than the actual minutes and hours you log into a game. It's how you think about it, how you talk about it, the writing about it that springs forth, the all of that stuff. What we're doing right now, even in the pod, even in the turn-based podcasting about it that will occur in the future.
Exactly. Hey, publishers, we are giving you value right now. anyway, it's fascinating, and I recommend Mark Dara's YouTube channel. It's got a lot of really interesting takes, and it's kind of cool seeing somebody that was in the trenches for so long be honest and forthright about what their career was like and all the insights that they came away with and reflections on the industry now. I think it's pretty cool. All right, before we get to our next story, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor, but we'll be right back. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace! Squarespace! Oh, our favorite. Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs, really anybody that needs a website. You can stand out. You can succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. My website, jeffcanada.com, a Squarespace website. Our website, dlcpod.com, a Squarespace website. The only way I make a website is if I use Squarespace. Christian's the same way. We built our websites using their tech. What is their tech? Oh, it's so good. Squarespace Blueprint AI. You can start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint. All you do is choose from a professionally curated layout and styling option, and then you build your unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand, to your business, to your needs, and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools so you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. Also, if you're selling anything, make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay. And in eligible countries, you can even offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. And with Squarespace AI, you can kickstart or update written content on any website, product description, or email. You generate instant, personalized results that know and show your brand identity. Explain what your site is about, choose your tone, and enter what you need to get short or long-form text. No matter the placement, Squarespace AI makes it easier to go live, stand out, and succeed online. You can upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on their beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. They have everything that you need. I'm telling you, this is the easiest way to have a website, to do what you need to get done online, and you can try all of it for free. Head over to squarespace.com/DLC. You'll get a free trial. And then when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with our promo code DLC. Again, that's squarespace.com/DLC to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain using code DLC. Check it out. All right, Danish, what is your story of the week?
Well, I'll say one thing about live games and dead games is if they don't die, then we can't remake them. I guess my story will be in the tradition of DLC. All the stories is things are being remade and remastered, and I like it. I guess I'll put it
there's a lot of remasters. Yes, this was the week of, hey, we just got through Summer Game Fest, and we got a whole lot of new. We drank from the fire hose of all the new game announcements. There's a lot of old games that we're now announcing. This is the week for remasters, remakes, even just hinting at remakes. So to cover everything that Danish is bringing up, we got a surprise reveal trailer for a remaster announcement of Star Wars Bounty Hunter, which is an old PS2 GameCube game that came out, oh, what year? I don't have the year in front of me. Anyway, this was right around the prequels time, I think, because it's all about Jango Fett and how Jango Fett became worked for Darth Tyrannus and made the clone army, became the blueprint for the clone army. A lot of cool stuff back in the day. That game is going to be remastered by Aspyre, which is a company that does a lot of excellent remasters. And it is coming out on PS5, PS4, Xbox Series, even Xbox One, Nintendo Switch, and Steam as well, all on August 1st, which happens to be my birthday. So that was a surprise trailer for that old game. I'm curious about both of your experiences with that. But I'll also mention we got Ubisoft CEO Yves Guillemot in an interview with his own company on their website, mentioning that we're in for some Assassin's Creed remakes. He's like, get ready, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be remaking some Assassin's Creeds. And we don't know exactly which ones yet, but it sounds like that's a big part of the blueprint. They want to have an Assassin's Creed game coming out. He says, quote, more regularly, but not for it to be the same experience every year. So maybe some of those years will be remakes, remasters. I'm curious what you guys think about that. And then the third one this week, which we will be hearing about, likely if you're listening to this podcast, it has already happened because when this podcast comes out, Monday, July 1st, there will be a Capcom Direct that is going to show more information, maybe some footage of the remaster of Dead Rising, the first Dead Rising game, which if you recall what the Dead Rising series is all about, taking pictures and putting cones on zombie heads inside a mall. Dead Rising, the first one, it's zombies in a mall. We're going to get a remaster of that. So, Danish.
Well, there's one more remaster you're missing. Someone's remastering Mario 64 onto the Game Boy Advance.
You're sucking up literally all the stories. I have nothing left.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I love it. It's great. Which of these remasters are you most excited about? Or do you think this is a good trend? Is it too many?
No.
Tell me what you think.
I really like this. And also, on the Star Wars Bounty Hunter thing, we had a Dark Forces remaster recently, and we had a Jedi Outcast on the ported to VR unofficially. There's like really cool Star Wars games from the Star Wars video game golden era, like basically before the prequels happened, but like in the 90s, that's all we had were video games, and then even post prequels. All we had were the video games. And so there were a lot of them, and a lot of them were good. And I didn't play a lot of them. So I'm going to definitely pick up Bounty Hunter Remastered because I've never played it. So it's gonna be really cool. I think though, the one that sticks out to me is the Assassin's Creed remakes, because I just want to hear two words, Black Flag. One of the best Assassin's Creed games ever made. It's the first one I truly fell in love with. Jeff, I was a lot like you in terms of like, I appreciated Assassin's Creed, but I never really got into it. Black Flag was the one that is like blew it wide open. I think after that, Origins was another big jump. I think Origins is probably my favorite. Black Flag and Origins are probably my two favorite Assassin's Creed games. So that would be a blast to play again. And then, well, yeah, Dead Rising also.
We heard a rumor that the team that had worked on Skull and Bones was originally doing just that, working on a remake of Black Flag, and then it kind of morphed into Skull and Bones. So I don't, I mean, it sounds like if he's talking about an Assassin's Creed remakes or remasters, that seems like a prime candidate.
Yeah, it's a pretty popular one too. I mean, I think it's one of those ones like people talk about Assassin's Creed 2 and they talk about Black Flag a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rich.
Oh yeah. I'm a fan of this particular trend from a game preservation standpoint primarily. I've been excited about a lot of the stuff that's come out this year. Wizardry got a really terrific remake that I just thought was so, from Digital Eclipse this year, that was so thoughtful in terms of how it, you know, where it let you customize the old schoolness of the experience, and you could play with more updated graphics, but then you could also see what the screen would look like. And it's almost like an educational tool on some of these sometimes, like where it's not just necessarily about here's, you know, a way to make this a cash grab or something, or like a relatively quote unquote simple cash grab. But I think there's more to it than that with some of these remakes. I mean, some probably are, could tilt a little bit more towards being like, we need to, you know, get, see if we can bring people back into this thing and make some money. But a lot of them have this really, I think, wonderful impulse that is like bringing new people into something that was great for a reason and reintroducing these games to a new audience. And I think that that's really awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of anything quite like this. It feels like we're really at this point now where the technology is, I mean, we just talked about, you know, Fidelity Death Cult, but here is leveraging Fidelity onto games that just couldn't achieve it, you know, were technologically restricted at the time that they were released, and we can make them feel a little bit more contemporary, feel a little bit more high fidelity now. And I'm all for it. I love the fact that a lot of these experiences were, you know, wonderful at the time, but would be even better if it's not like somebody making these games back then wouldn't have made them look better if they could have, right? They were pushing up against the boundaries of technology. So the fact that, like you said, Rich, people that have never had these experiences are going to have a chance to play them on modern systems and maybe with a little bit sharper images. I don't know how many of these are specifically going to be remakes as opposed to the remaster. Certainly the Bounty Hunter, based on the trailer, is much more of a remaster where it looks very similar to how the game originally looked. Crisper, higher frame rate perhaps, but that's a game I remember playing on GameCube, I think. So I'm sure this experience is going to be just the fact that you've got, you know, two sticks for a third person action game instead of the old Wave Bird, which had, I don't know, the weird center stick.
It had two sticks.
I guess it did, but it was one of them was
stick and a dynamic stick. Yeah. No, that you're thinking of N64. It was more normal. Yeah.
Fair enough.
But in addition to the fidelity, the thing I actually appreciate the most about these remakes are bringing them up to speed in terms of just modern game design as well. Like not only just accessibility options, which I think are really important, but just fundamental game design things. Like, hey, we kind of took it for granted this certain clunkiness in terms of game design. And a lot of those things, when they come back, are really improved a lot. Sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in really great ways, you know. Even a game that's as good as like Resident Evil 4, some of the changes they made to the game design is really, really smart and made that game. I mean, it was like that remake was game of the year in a lot of places. So that's the part of it that I really also look forward to.
Yeah. I haven't heard either of you mention Dead Rising. I played a lot of that game.
Dude, I love Dead Rising. Dead Rising 1 was so fun. And
yeah,
it's, I, I didn't play a lot of the sequels, but I feel like that's a franchise that never actually hit the same spark of the first one in any of the subsequent ones.
I agree. Yeah.
I feel like going back to the first one, remastering or remaking that one, I would really look forward to. Also, it was kind of, I mean, it was a roguelite before roguelites were as popular as they are now, you know?
I think that's true. Yeah. Yeah. It was like, what zaniness can you do this run through the mall? Yeah. Can you get all the way to being whisked away by the helicopter? Not this time, but maybe next time.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. That's a good point. I didn't even think of it that way.
I just like that it's a literal dead game that is now rising.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Dead game rising. They got to call it Dead Rising Rising.
Dead Rising Rising. Oh, that's funny. I love how goofy it was. I think, wasn't the main character named Frank Castle or something? No, Frank Castle is the Punisher. Frank something.
Frank West.
Frank West, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was, it's just goofy, and he's like this photographer that gets, anyway. Maybe this points to Capcom thinking about bringing this franchise back. They'll see if this does well as a remaster, and I don't know. We'll know more when the Capcom event happens in just one more day. But I'm kind of excited about playing Dead Rising again after all these years.
Yeah.
Another thought occurred to me that I thought I'd share with you guys, because you, Danish, so smartly pointed out it's the first roguelite. I had a thought. Maybe this is not a unique thought. Maybe somebody else has thought this, and I'm late to the party. But I thought, you know, we have this whole genre of games called boss rush games, And I thought the first boss rush game ever might have been Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. All sure. Bosses.
Yeah.
Only bosses.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. It's anyway. Good.
As for my story of the week, we got an interview in the wake of the Final Shape release with Destiny 2. Assistant game editor Robbie Stevens had an interview with Edge magazine, and they were talking about the end of year 10 of Destiny 2. It's been going for 10 years. This is, you know, the perfect example of the kinds of games we were talking about before, games that have a long tail that keep on trucking, forever games. And they're talking about year 11, what year 11 will bring to Destiny 2.
I don't those words.
Year 11?
I cannot believe it's been going. I mean, kudos to them. That's incredible.
I mean, yeah, the fact that it's the sequel and it's 10 years old.
In another 10 years, Destiny will be able to drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no mention of a Destiny 3. I mean, I think it's funny because, you know, no one there at Bungie wanted to call the game Destiny 2. You know, they just wanted to keep making Destiny. And it's so funny that they were forced to make Destiny 2 and then they got what they wanted. And now it's like, it's so weird that Destiny 2 is the thing that has endured. But be that as it may, they are thinking about year 11. And one of the things that they mention in this, Robbie Stevens mentions in this interview, is that they're kind of moving away from this linear episodic storytelling, what he calls TV storytelling, which, you know, modeled after serialized television model, is, you know, each new expansion tells the story of this group of characters and the next thing that happens and the next thing that happens, and they move toward this crescendo, which was the Final Shape. Their plan, or at least what he's hinting at with the next decade of storytelling, starting with year 11, is that they will kind of move away from that and make it more, less episodic, less serialized, and more about world building and exploring different stories. They talk about expanding the world, expanding the universe of Destiny, and letting players pop in and pop out. And so it's not like, oh, hey, I have to have known all the stuff that's happened to get to season 4 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I can just watch any episode I want because it's more like The Simpsons, and I can just enjoy that episode and it's self-contained.
This seems like an elaborate way to confess to people that actually there were more shapes in there all along.
They've invented a new shape.
Shape rising.
Yeah.
The finalist
shape. Shape rising. what do you make of this, Rich? Do you think this is a wiser route? Obviously it's a weird thing with Destiny in particular, because a lot of the older content that is, you know, the equivalent of early seasons of a television show, you can't even play. Like, you jump into Destiny 2 right now, you can't play that older content. So maybe that dictates this in and of itself. But I wonder, as a player, what you're more interested in, an ongoing story that evolves with these kind of forever games, or something that is a little more self-contained and lets you jump in or jump out.
I mean, I think there's a time and place for both of those things, and both of those things are innately interesting. I think what the challenge is going to be for Destiny 2 here is that it is something which has been built to contain the first thing it did, and it's done that now, and now you're going to be doing something else, and the game that they have built was meant to be kind of an episodic ongoing thing. So there's opportunity in this change, but it's also, I wonder if the audience that's there came for what they were, and it's always going to be a challenge to bring people to a new thing, though I do think it's worth doing. Like, I'm always excited by any sort of creative, like taking a swing and trying something else out, even if it doesn't work or have the same degree of success that the first thing had. So, you know, I'm pro this move for them. I love that they've got the team there. It's not like they finished the thing and they have to dismantle that team and people have to look for work, because we've had enough stories like that. So it's including stories from the Destiny team like that. But it's nice to see, like, yeah, they're going to do some other things and keep their community going. And I don't know how long it would last, because I every game dies eventually, right? Like, we've been talking about that. I'm curious to see what this will bring for the Destiny community, and how they'll manage the challenge of telling a more truncated, shorter stories, you know, instead of like the broad overarching ongoing campaign. It's like they're moving from like running D&D games the way, you know, teenagers do, where you can just keep going forever and play forever, to the way adults do, which is where it's like, I can drop in maybe once a year.
Yeah.
So let's see what we can do.
Yeah. Dennis, what's your take on this shift?
This is really appealing to me, because I played a decent amount of Destiny 1 and a little bit of Destiny 2. And I never really got into the story, because I think I was playing it before there kind of was one. It was the Grimoire cards era of Destiny.
Right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is, you know, maybe a hot take, but I feel like this is a potentially a wider trend that we're seeing in multiple forms of media. You know, recently The Acolyte came out on Disney Plus, and that was very much kind of advertised as a, hey, you don't need to know anything. This is hundreds of years before, new story, no Skywalker saga, you know, just jump in. This is a great jumping in point. And we're seeing it with this of like, hey, we want people to jump in anytime. And then, you know, I think that what we've seen with the MCU starting to crumble a little bit, it's like, this stuff is very, you know, difficult to keep up with after a certain point. And so I personally do like this kind of new shift. And as Rich said, like, I think there's room for both in a lot of ways. So, but I'm certainly very excited. I have a pitch. I think they should call it a completely different name with a subtitle, A Destiny Story.
Yeah, I like it. New shapes, A Destiny Story. I forgive me for the cynicism, but I read this and I immediately went, cut to 2 years from now when they're like, the next expansion, we're bringing back the old characters and we're returning to that style of storytelling you loved.
But
where
you know what I'll say though, like you're probably not wrong, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think just do it, let it rest for a while, bring it right. back for those fans, and then put it back in its toy box a little bit and do something else. Like I think that would be really cool, actually.
Well, I know you're not wrong. Yeah. I think that's kind of what it needs. When something lasts that long, ultimately, what you need is variety. Mm-hmm. You know, you need those ebbs and flows of different kinds of feelings. And I think a great thing to point to is World of Warcraft, which, you know, there are groups of expansions that try doing certain things and then other expansions that do other things. And it's like, yeah, you can't just have the game be the same thing and last that long. It really does need to evolve and shift. And I think as much as I decry the downsides of these forever games, and I think those are significant, there are really cool upsides of games that last that long, that endure, that have these kinds of evolutions, and it can really be a living thing that changes. And you know, you think back, oh yeah, I played it during the Grimoire era, or you know, I played WoW when the talent trees were this and that. That is a cool thing. So I don't think it's all bad, but it is, it's hard to manufacture that, you know. It's kind of, you got to just sort of like evolve naturally into it.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, we got a ton of games to talk about because these guys have come armed with really juicy stuff. Let's take another quick break for a sponsor and we'll be right back with our playlist.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
All right, let's dig into the games that we've been playing in a segment we call The Playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on The Playlist. All right, usually what we do on the show is we let the guest talk about all the games that they've been playing, and then Christian will talk about all the games he's been playing, and then I'll talk about all the games I've been playing. I want to do something a little different this week because let's final shape it up. I think we should each, we'll just do it round robin style. I won't participate very much because I don't got tons of stuff on my list, but I want to hear you guys go back and forth. Rich, we'll start with you, and I know that even on your list there's some overlap, which is exciting.
Oh yeah, we've got some overlap, so let me start with the non-overlap first.
Okay.
Because this is I actually played this game that I'm about to talk about, and one of my first thoughts was I need to go on DLC again so that I can get Jeff to buy this game. So the game is called Scald Against the Black Prairie, and it's essentially True Detective Season 1 delivered via the medium of Ultima 5 is how I would describe it.
Amazing. That's such,
I mean, I just
so
purchased
well
it. I just bought it.
it is an incredible work. It's a RPG. It's tile-based like those old school Ultima games are. It has an art style that's very evocative of that, but it looks the way like you remember those things looking. Like it just has such a mood and an atmosphere. But the main thing that Scald has going for it is its writing and its storytelling. I think a lot of times it's hard to, and I know there's another Lovecraftian kind of style thing on our greater playlist that I'm looking at here, so I'd be curious to compare notes, but it's often very hard to pull that off well, and what Scald is doing is so interesting because it does have this like big epic RPG feel, but you're also getting this very doomed sensation as you're playing it, and it's very different than when you do these fantasy RPGs. They're all very heroic, or if they're not heroic, they're kind of grimdark in a specific way. This is something else entirely. It has this kind of foreboding tension to it. Like, you really feel like you are on a doomed journey. And it is really well plotted out, like, in terms of how this is built from the point of view of narrative construction. It's absolutely tremendous. And because it's not a 100 hour RPG, this is like a 30 to 40 hour RPG, depending how you go. And because it feels so tight as a result of that, like, it just, like, from the jump, I think you'll know immediately, like, the storytelling, like, you get your tutorial, like, some stuff happens, and then you, like, you get this flashback, and it uses, you know, it cuts away at dramatic times and tells the story at different moments. It uses a lot of storytelling techniques that are less common in video games, more common in film. And then on top of that, you have a really terrific RPG with 8 or 9 classes that you can choose from. You customize your character, and the play style is like, feels a really appropriate amount of crunchy, but also accessible at the same time. Like, it's not super fiddly. It's very intuitive. But it elevates that, like, Ultima 5 style combat, which is just a bunch of tiles bumping into each other. And this gives you all sorts of different feats depending on what kind of character you're playing. And all the characters play very differently. And there's some really cool classes there. And it's the type of game that makes me want to, oh, I want to go in and try experimenting with, you know, I played a rogue, but, like, what is this particular spellcaster like? And it's just such a well put together gem of an RPG. Scald Against the Black Priory is something, it's in contention for my game of the year already. We were fortunate enough on Gamers with Jobs to get an interview with the dev, Anders Lauterson, and just hearing the story of how, like, basically, you know, he has a lot of freelancers that he ended up hiring to, like, fill out the art and the music. And I have to shout out the music. The music is, it feels like music, like that MIDI style music from games in the 90s, but good. You know what I mean? It's like not annoying. It's like, the combat music is tremendous in Scald.
Like, I just bought my Adlib sound card.
Yep. And you'll know it immediately. Like, the title screen will come up and you'll be like, oh, I am home. If you started in Ultima 5, and you will just go into it. It's also like a game that does a terrific job with being spare on exposition and just heavy on move and mood, and lets you figure things out, is smart enough to, or trust you to be smart enough to go with it. And I'm always a sucker for that. It's like, treat me like I know what I'm doing and can think about things, and I'll be wrapped around your finger.
Well,
I can't recommend Scald enough. I think it's if you ever played an Ultima, I think you should be mandated to play Scald if you've played and enjoyed an Ultima game. But even absent that, I think it's a really incredible RPG that is doing things with storytelling that just I just don't see in the space in that genre in particular. So yeah, huge shout out to Scald, and please, like, pause the podcast and buy it. Go to Steam and buy it. It's a tremendous experience.
I'm looking at it on Steam right now. It's in my cart. If you're keeping track at home, the current Jeff Wallet hit is $14.99.
Yeah, very affordable.
Yeah, well, so
far.
We're
going to get those numbers up. That's too low. We're going to get those up.
The night is young, boys. But another thing I love about this game, looking at it on Steam, is that it looks like they made an old school live action 90s video game commercial.
I want to talk about this. This is so good. I saw the same thing. I had the same thought. It's like, oh, it's so amazing. Well done.
They got the young kid who's, like, in the darkly lit attic. and the his cardboard box in the attic starts glowing, and he looks inside it, and it's Scald against the Black Priori is in there, and he puts it in his PC, and it changes his life, you know? So many great commercials like that from when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's that alone should tell you like where this is, like in its heart, where this game rests. It says everything. Like, yeah, it's a great commercial.
It definitely evokes Ultimas, which, you know, Ultima 7 is my favorite game of all time. I love the whole franchise except the last two. It also evokes like the old D&D gold box games, like Pools of Radiance. Kind of totally. Looks like those games as well. This is in my cart.
Yes.
So I guess that brings us to Danish. Danish, what else am I buying?
Okay, well, I'll also start with the ones unique to us. Still Wakes the Deep. It is the new game from the Chinese Room, which they did. Oh my God, I'm blanking. Everyone's Gone to the Rapture, Amnesia. Yeah. Great sort of studio with amazing pedigree of these types of games. And this is, so far, I'm like really early. I've only scratched the surface. Maybe my favorite one. The setting is incredible. You're on this sort of oil rig in the North Sea, and everyone on the rig I've met so far is like Scottish, has this like amazing Scottish brogue accent. And it's amazing sort of atmosphere. It's that the premise is kind of like John Carpenter's The Thing. You know, it's these people out in the middle of nowhere in this remote facility, and you know, supernatural things happen. But what I really appreciate about this game is, one, it looks phenomenal. And this is kind of what I was talking about earlier of like, hey, this is the kind of game you're making. This is where you need to put the resources is to making this thing completely immersive. Amazing graphics, but the performances are incredible. The acting, the facial animation, it's all great. And the writing is so good because in the first, you know, 20 minutes, you get through very natural, not at all forced exposition where you're piecing together the backstory of these characters, of why the main character is on this oil rig. What is he running away from? What sort of, you know, problems that he's dealing with, that's all becomes the backdrop for this larger story. So I don't want to say too much about it. There's not much I can say without just like going through the awesome beats of it. But I think, and it's also, you know, a shorter game. I believe it's on Game Pass. So no reason not to check it out. I think I saw on how long to beat. It's like 4 hours, 5-6 hours, something actually reasonable for me. I can't play any game longer than that. So Still Wakes the Deep. It's an awesome game. I cannot wait to go back and keep playing it. It reminded me a little bit of Soma. I don't think it was Chinese Room. Someone else did Soma, but that was kind of like also a undersea, like spooky first person narrative type game, which I loved. This is right in my wheelhouse.
Very cool. And my wallet is grateful that it's on Game Pass. I don't have to add to the total. Still Wakes the Deep is the name of that game. And we're back to you, Rich.
All right. Since we're not going to do overlap yet, I have one. This might be your wallet's breather, because from what I know about you. But I feel like we probably should talk about Elden Ring's expansion, Shadow of the Erdtree. Which has recently come out and created kind of a very interesting and useful discussion about difficulty in games. But I don't want to jump into that immediately because I think that undercuts or is only a small part of what is special about this particular DLC. So for some context, From Games, From is pretty notorious for slamming it out of the park with their DLCs. Like their DLCs in Bloodborne, terrific. The DLC in the original Dark Souls is like where this reputation springs from. It's phenomenal. And I think Shadow of the Erdtree is very much continuing that tradition. It is a jaw-droppingly beautiful expansion. Like, we're talking Terrence Malick film level beauty. It's like every frame of this thing is just gorgeous and dreamlike and beautiful in a very specific, unique way. You know, it's like somebody condensed the entirety of the movie, The Green Knight, into a video game in some way. It's really something else. And what it brings to Elden Ring is, I think, a little bit more of a plottier narrative in some ways. Like there's it's a From game. It's still like the esoteric dialogue and everything feels like very much like a step removed from being completely lucid, but makes some sort of intuitive sense. But there's still like the way that this expansion works is you are tracking down Mikaela, who's last seen in Elden Ring, in a looking extremely dead in a bloody cocoon, and you kind of go into this other realm and uncover a lot about the lore of Elden Ring in there. But you're also in this because you're chasing after a person and there's other forces at work. It feels very dynamic in terms of its storytelling in a way that a lot of From games often do not. It's like in some ways it's kind of closer to an Armored Core 6 in how it's telling its story. And I just think that's really interesting. And there's just some really fun and incredible creatures and ideas and designs in Shadow of the Erdtree. To bring it back a little bit to that difficulty discussion, I do think it's like also a really interesting one to have because, you know, these games are notoriously challenging, and Elden Ring has this other additional challenge of it being a lot more mainstream than other From games. I think it sold something like, what is it, over 30 million copies or something enormous. So there's a much bigger pool of people here, and it brings into some real questions about like how where is the line on being overtuned for difficulty? Mm-hmm. But it also brings up some questions about how well I think From is at communicating the tools that are at the disposal to the players, because there's also of course the weird online toxic get good bro who says you can't use any of the summons or anything. Of course those tools do exist, you can use them. Miyazaki uses them apparently when he plays the games, so it's like there's nothing wrong with using those tools. But there's other stuff that, you know, I hear people, we talked a little bit about this on Gamers with Jobs that we recorded today. And one of our hosts was like lamenting all the ruins that he was losing when he would die behind boss doors. And then he realized that there's actually a thing you can put in your flask of wondrous physics, which lets you retain your ruins after death. So he like put that in his flask, went into the boss room, picked up his ruins, chugged the flask, and just waited for the boss to kill him so he could wake up outside of the boss room with his flask and all of his stuff. It's like, oh, this is actually like manageable. And I very few people, it was later revealed in an off mic discussion that people don't use rune arcs, which are very powerful and let you like get all these buffs and bonuses. So I think there's a really interesting thing happening there that's worth thinking about in terms of how From communicates the tools that make it more possible for, you know, the people who aren't willing to, you know, throw themselves at a boss for several days in a row to memorize patterns that can be performed by old hands.
right. You know? Right.
And I think that's an interesting discussion happening, I just think it's like a neat side discussion that is, has some healthy corners to it if you avoid the usual toxic suspects. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, Danish, I know you're a huge fan of Elden Ring. Has the talk of difficulty put you off the expansion, or you just haven't gotten to it yet?
Oh, no, there's no way I'm playing this. I mean, I love Elden Ring. I got to, oh my God. Renalia, is that her name? That's where I hit the wall and peaced out, but on good terms. It's like, okay, I love this game. This game's amazing. I cannot beat this boss. you know, nice to have known you, Elden Ring. Yeah. But the thing actually, Rich, it's like, I've heard that you have, there is a skill check in terms of even starting the DLC, which I don't think I've gotten that far. There's a couple of bosses you have to beat, right? So
yeah,
even if I wanted to, I couldn't play this.
Yeah. Does that bother you? I mean, you're a huge fan of this game. There's more game. You know, Rich talks about how gorgeous it is.
I do feel a little FOMO about it, but again, I just don't, it's not possible for me. It's physically impossible for me to have the reaction times required. Right. But I will say though, that I did use lots of summons and runes and stuff like that. And I thought it was awesome. And I beat a lot of hard bosses with it. And I really did love the game because it unlike previous Souls games, and maybe this was always the case, but it didn't click for me until Elden Ring, is like the world, the battles, everything is a puzzle to solve. It's like Mega Man. If you don't equip the right thing, you will get destroyed. But if you play smart and you get the actual correct sort of patterns and tactics and weapons and summons and all that stuff, you can kind of put together like a plan, and then you can execute on that plan. And if it works, it feels amazing.
I don't know how far into this we want to get, but I just think that somebody like you who loves the game should be the target audience for this DLC.
Right.
You know, the fact that it's beyond you is no fault of your own. I don't lay that at your feet. I just feel like from a design goal perspective, like, does that feel like a misstep?
No, I don't think so. Because here's the thing. And this is something that I preach, and so therefore I also believe it, is that sometimes it's not for you. And so this DLC is just not for me. It's like, it's for the people who, you know, are super fans that want more difficulty, and I'm happy that they get it. It's not for me. And I kind of wish when more people encounter things that are not for them, that they don't feel entitled to them.
to that notion.
But why would you be so healthy with your mindset?
Rich, aside from that comment that I think we can all applaud and agree with, do you concur? I mean, do you feel like it's a loss that clearly, you know, I don't think Danish is I think he's representative of a large swath of that player base, probably a larger swath. I mean, there's me who like just is put off by the whole thing. And that's
still
not what
I want to get you into it. At this point, it's been so long that I can't even Sherpa you anymore. We're going to go in together, but I still want you to, I remember the thing I told you before is like, just run away from everybody. Just try to find as many campfires as you can. Like in just doing that, you will experience what I think is the best thing about the game is the world. And you'll see the beautiful like intricacies of how the world is designed. But anyway, I still think you should get a shot in that regard.
I mean, yeah. That's a whole other conversation. Yeah, my point being that we're not even talking about the me's of the world. We're talking about people who are already sold on the greatness of this game. And like, there's a part of me that feels that it's a shame that, you know, and I love the enlightened perspective of it. You know, it's not made for me, but like, shouldn't it have been? What do you think, Rich?
I mean, I think that that's a really healthy perspective to have about anything in life, really. Like, and being just to be able to be like, something is not for me for whatever the reason might be, and to be like really happy that it's for, like, there are people out there who it is for sure. I do think that perspective can coexist behind a perspective of like, maybe there needs to be some conversation about the tuning of this. I mean, to an a thing did happen where From did make this DLC a little bit easier. They updated the patch and they made it so that some of the early enemies weren't quite hitting as hard. But another thing about it is, so the DLC has its own leveling system that is separate from the base game, whereby you get these blessings, and the blessings are really like they filter everything. They filter how strong you are in the DLC area. So, and they don't do anything out of the area, out of the DLC area. So you could come into the DLC with a character who's basically sprinted there, and you'll be totally viable as soon as you, you know, you get, you know, you get your first Skidoo tree blessing, and you're off to the races. You know, you're just as, you know, my 165 level spell sword character and your 40 level random build character, we'll both be able to tackle what's going on here. You just have to be able to get to the DLC for that, which is its own thing. I do think, in addition to that, is there's other ways to experience a game aside from playing it these days. Like, I do think it's a aesthetically beautiful enough experience that it's worth, like, see somebody stream it for a little bit, because there's so many. I talked about, like, I compared it to, like, Terrence Malick films, and I'm not kidding about it. It's like, really, like, there are some of the vistas there that are just like, my jaw's just on the floor at how this thing looks, and how just the feeling of being in this world is so palpable and specific and unlike anything else that it, you know, it's worth doing. And I do think Elden Ring has a lot of tools that you can take advantage of. And, you know, you might be, whether it's like getting the friend to come and help you beat it or using all the different consumables, I think there's a way to get there. You know, and the online guides, like, look up the easiest, most broken build that can let you kite every enemy from a safe distance, and get there by playing it in whatever way makes the most sense for you and helps you get through things. Once you're past the once you're past a certain boss, you can you even get free respecs, essentially, that let you just, like, oh, you run into a problem because you've got a magic based build and the enemy's highly resistant to magic. Well, you can switch out of that for a fight and then go right back into it if you want.
I'm going to say something kind of controversial. So I did this actually for Starfield, where I like that game. I played a decent amount of it, like 6 hours, which is like crazy for me. But but I didn't love the combat. I think what happened was I spec'd weirdly, and all my stuff was really weak. And so at a certain point, and the thing about Bethesda games, which I love, is they completely advertise their, like, cheats. You know, you put tilde or command or whatever, and you type in, you know, God mode or whatever. It's like classic id Doom style. And I love that the Bethesda does that. So I actually played a decent amount of Starfield with just, like, you know, easy combat. Like, okay, never die, just whatever. And then I would talk to people and I would play the story, which is what I was there for. So I am actually very tempted to just get, I have Elden Ring on PS5, I believe. And, I'm very tempted to just get it on PC again and just play with mods and cheats and just play the world, like, experience the world how I want to experience it. I personally don't feel anything wrong with that. I, even when, as a developer, when I make games, there's lots of debates about, like, how much do we force the player to do any given thing? And I always take the side of let the player play how they want to play. So, you know, if they want to skip cutscenes, if they want to do whatever, if they want to save scum, if they want to do whatever, it's like, let them do it. They can enjoy it the way they want to enjoy it. There is a certain amount of, like, a core to the game that you have an authorial intent. But if they want to change that, then that's on them and that's fine. So, so anyway, I kind of am tempted to get this on PC and just cheat and then just play it and experience the world and just go through it. Because I think, again, what I love about that game is the world building. And I love and I do like the combat too, but, you know, I'm not that good at it. So I'll take a few cheats. I have no shame in that.
I'd be tempted to do that too. And you know,
I'd encourage that. And if any of you guys are on PS5 and do want some help, like, I'm happy to come in and also die against the same boss with you.
But... well, I'll die.
Moral support.
Yeah. I love it. All right. That's Elden Ring Shadow of the Erdtree. One of the things on Rich's playlist. Danish, you're up.
All right. So this is something that we've both been playing, and we don't have to spend too much long on this because I really do want to talk about the next game, and Rich, I want you to sort of lead that one. But Solium Infernum is a strategy, multiplayer sort of a civilization-esque strategy game that takes place in hell. And you play one of five or six sort of, I don't know what you call them, lieutenants of hell that are trying to increase their standing in the pandemonium, the court, the government of hell. It's a great setup. I love the theme. I love the world. I love the characters and the writing. It's so sort of like delicious in how like hellish it is. It's so fun. It's a weird thing to say, but like just the writing and how they really lean into the bureaucracy of hell, which is so fun. There's so much bureaucracy and it's so fun. Like, so you want to expand your sort of, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, your cantons, these spaces on the playing field, but you can't cross over to anybody else's. And you can't just like attack them and start a war. In order to attack them, you have to like either like make a decree or like insult them, and then they have a chance to respond to your insult or declare war. It's like all this very bureaucratic thing. It's really fun. It's all turn-based. I've actually been playing it, which is a really cool feature. I've been playing it asynchronously turn-based.
Yeah,
so,
neat.
It's an awesome thing. And what's so great about it is you set up a game and it asks you, do you want to do it like simultaneously or async? I don't think there's any reason not to always just choose async, because what happens is you can then leave the game and then you could start doing it async for a while. Like someone will do a turn one day, you do the turn the next day. You can kind of set like what the limits are. If nobody takes a turn in a certain number of days, then they'll get penalized for it or whatever. But then also, and this is what we've done, we were playing asynchronously for a couple of weeks. And then it's like, hey, let's finish this round out. We're almost into the kind of end game. Let's just get a night. And so we all kind of got on group chat and Discord or whatever, and just played our asynchronous game as if it was just live turn-based, it was great.
Cool, yeah.
So it's the way that it can kind of go between those is really fun.
It's like Civ. You can do it like in Civ.
Yeah.
I mean, it is what it is. It's Hell Civ.
It's
basically
Hell Civ.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Civ, except you're getting artifacts of evil and manuscripts made out of human flesh and playing a devil, and the bureaucracy thing is like 100%. It's like there are four different currencies in the game, and there's no change. So if you're paying for things, you have to have like the specific currency.
That's actually my only gripe, and I get why they do it, is the currency thing, because they want to slow you down. Like if you have a lot of currency, then you have to spend a turn to consolidate it to pay for it. I think it might be a necessary evil, no pun intended, for the game design. I'm not very good at this game because there are so many systems. And I think this is actually sort of a blessing and a curse. I think it's a little bit hard to get into because there's so many systems. I will say the tutorial actually does a really good job, although I've noticed online that you can break the tutorial very easily. So just be careful and do only what it tells you to do, because if you can, it won't stop you from doing other things, but then it'll just break the tutorial. So just be warned. Just do what it tells you to do and you'll be fine. But
you got to be lawful evil, not chaotic evil, people.
Yeah, just
follow the instructions.
In every part of this game, you can't get away from
it. But so what's great though, like, is once you do learn all of the different systems, it's so wide in what ways you can try to win, and that's why I'm not very good at it, because I don't fully understand every single system as much as I should. But even the kind of few things that I do know how to do, I'm still having a lot of fun with it. So yeah, it's an awesome game.
It's called Solium Infernum. And Rich, it sounds like you are also enjoying it.
Oh yeah. It's just a terrific, if you're into civilization, but you want to like flavor it up with some of that sweet, sweet hell flavor. Yeah, it's a blast. Get some friends, play it asynchronously. You can set the turns for like 1 week time limit if you want. So you can, have your busy, complicated life and then come back into this and be like, what was I trying to scheme about? I don't remember.
Hell Civ. Yeah, exactly. They should have gone with Hell Civ. Hell Civ is pretty good. Solium Infernum is the actual title. And it is on Steam sale until July 11th, 40% off this game. So if you are curious about it, now is the time.
You got to get that. Jeff, yeah. Put that in your cart.
All right. $24 more. Add it up. Add it up. All right. And then the next game that you guys have both playing, Rich, you can take lead on this, is Nine Souls, right?
Yes. So Nine Souls. Souls is spelled S-O-L-S. And Nine Souls is... I picked up Nine Souls initially because I wanted something to scratch that I'm waiting for Silk Song itch. And what I was not expecting was that, oh, this isn't just like a placeholder for Silk Song. This Nine Souls is legitimately in the conversation. It's a direct competitor. Yeah. It's so...
I totally agree.
Good. It's the only thing, it's much like Hollow Knight took kind of a little bit of a Dark Souls aesthetic and put it into the Metroidvania boots and then did its own thing. This Nine Souls is doing that, except instead of being inspired by Dark Souls, it's a little more inspired by Sekiro. And the style from it is from Red Candle Games. They're a Chinese developer. And the style that they refer to this game as is Dao Punk. So it's one part cyberpunk and one part like Taoist monks. And if you were to look at the Steam page for Nine Souls, you will see what looks like a very pleasant looking cat and like very pretty graphics. But do not let that fool you. This game goes hard. It is a brutal, and it's gory in a way, in such a specific way. Like it is, they even put a warning out that there's cruelty in the game, and they're not joking about that. Like the first scene is like you getting your like fall, like basically dangling off a cliff and somebody sending you to your apparent death. And your head just dashing against the rocks below. And it's really like beautiful, but like shocking. And there's a lot of surprising and shocking gore in Nine Souls. And it's always really delightful. It's also, it's also a game that tells its story in a really compelling fashion. Like you are piecing things together slowly, you're getting information via flashback at certain times, and just mechanically what it is doing with the fighting is also really interesting. I think a lot of people will hear it's based on Sekiro and think, oh god, no, is this going to be a parry timing thing? And yes, but it's doing stuff with the parry that most games don't do, and part of that is folding the parry into the traversal mechanisms of the game in a certain way. And there's like different types of parries that the game gives you at certain points. And it's just really thoughtful and neat. And it's also just to, if you're worried about difficulty, because this is a challenging game, it is also a game that has an easy mode that lets you manually put in how much damage you would like to receive versus how much damage you would like to do. If you keep it at its base setting, it is definitely a challenging game. Like, no mistake about it, but it's a really satisfying challenge. I think the default difficulty is extremely well tuned. But if it's too much or you're really running up against a wall, you can just shift it to easy mode, fiddle with how much damage you're receiving. The other nice thing about it is that even on its standard difficulty level, if you miss your parry timing, it's still forgiving, because you don't, if you tried to parry and you got up and you were maybe just a little bit too early, you'll take basically temporary damage that will slowly regenerate, but you'll have like a good enough. If you get the perfect parry, you don't take any damage. But even if you do take some damage, you'll get that you'll get a chance to kind of earn some of that health back if you don't get hit again, or there's certain types of powers that you can get in the game that will let you regain some of that health like right after you've lost it, like if you hit an enemy. So there's a lot that you can do to play with your build in Nine Souls to be a specific thing, and then the game itself lets you fine tune the difficulty. And I am just continuously impressed with this game. It surprised me, like the way the story develops is shocking and surprising at times. And it really has kept me on my toes. And there's been, I'm near the end of the game right now. I haven't beat Nine Souls yet, but I'm at I think maybe two or three bosses away from the end. And, it's just, knocking it out of the park, from start to finish. I think it's a really phenomenal work. And if you're somebody who liked Hollow Knight, you probably should get this, put it in your cart. It's really its own aesthetic thing that the Dao Punk stuff is tremendous. It's just like it's so fun and inventive. And, Red Candle Games has, they have other works. And like the surprising thing about this is they've never made a game like this. And to come out of the gate at this, with this quality and this caliber of a genre that I think is really, hard to be fresh in right now, right? Like there's a lot of Metroidvanias out there that are fine or even good, but this is something special. Nine Souls. I think
I'm seeing somebody on the Steam page call it Cat Kiro. I'll die at least twice, which I thought was very clever.
That's good.
Dennis, you're also playing Nine Souls.
Yeah, I'm still super early. I've only played for about an hour, maybe a little bit more. And so, but I, even in the short time I've played, I agree with everything Rich is saying. I think it's phenomenal. The art is incredible. It's this very sort of thin line work, flat shaded kind of game. It reminded me in a completely different way, but a little bit of Banner Saga in that kind of art style, very hand drawn, very like just, yeah, lush. And then the cyberpunk stuff, which is so cool. It's funny, I didn't hear that term Dao Punk, which is totally what it is, because the game that I thought of most while playing this was Talos Principle. This is Talos Principle type game in terms of its story and what it's trying to say about like theism and technology and transferring souls and consciousness and all that stuff that you love to see. It's all in there and it's part of it and it's beautiful. And then the combat's great. I'm a little early, so I haven't seen the depth that you're describing. But as I was playing this, I'm thinking everything's in place. Like once I sort of get into the meat of the combat, we'll see. But right now, like you said, this is on par. Like this for me might even surpass Hollow Knight as a game because of how much I love the aesthetic, because of how much I love the story, how dark it is, how interesting it is, the questions it raises, all those sorts of things. And so far the combat's really fun. One thing I'll point out about the parry, you mentioned that it has these great little systems that kind of ease you into it. One of the things is the audio design, where every attack actually has a little like ding to it. So I'm telling you, that one thing, if like any old Super Hall Souls game had an equivalent of that, it's way more of a help than you would ever imagine it is, because you're now using more visual and audio, like you're using audio cues in additional to, more senses. Yeah. That's what I was trying to say. You're using more senses to get a sense of that timing. And so to me, I thought that was awesome. And I cannot wait to go back to this game. This is like the kind of game where I'm just, when I'm not playing it, I'm itching to go back to play it.
Well, it's another $30 in my cart.
Yes.
I just on that audio sound, the audio note, I think that's really a really great observation, because the sound cues will communicate to you how to parry. Because if you miss the parry, if you're too late and you miss it, then you will hear the sound of getting hit. If you're a little bit early, but you didn't get it perfectly, you get one sound. And then if you get it perfectly, you get a different sound. And it really helps you time things out. I also really need to commend Nine Souls for some of its boss designs. I think generally the challenge with anything, even Hollow Knight kind of has this challenge a little bit, where it's hard to make each boss feel like fresh and interesting. And Nine Souls absolutely does. Like all the boss stuff is tremendous. There's one of the boss fights there. I would put it up there as possibly my favorite boss fight in one of these ever in terms of what it was wow. asking of me of as the player, how it managed to take something which seemed impossible but made it very possible and changed it up in multiple phases. It's like a breathtaking like standing up applauding, like breathtaking wow. kind of boss design. And to like bust that out in the middle of the game was also like tremendous. I'm like, there's more.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, again, that's Nine Souls, S-O-L-S. I knew these guys would bring amazing games, and they have not disappointed.
I will say Nine Souls. I actually had some trouble finding it. You have to spell out nine as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, not souls, the number. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Just a good thing to note. And the earlier game that Rich talked about is spelled Scald against the Black Priori is spelled S-K-A-L-D, Scald. I don't have to take too much time. I did get into the closed alpha, I think it is, not beta, closed alpha. Was invited into it for Fragpunk, which is one of the myriad hero shooters that we have seen announced in just the last several months. This one, I think, debuted at the Xbox event at some point. As anybody who listened to the show knows for a long time, you know, not super into the Souls games, also not super into competitive first-person shooters, multiplayer shooters. It's not my genre of choice, but I was intrigued by this, and I'm always intrigued by a multiplayer shooter because I'm looking for that game that's going to hook me. I want to be involved. I want to be into this genre. I just, you know, maybe Marvel will get it done for me. I don't know who. I put a lot of time into the first Overwatch when it came out because I had some friends playing it. Anyway, I jumped into Fragpunk, and I came away with two thoughts. The first is this game is really cool. It's really cool. Aesthetically, particularly so. I love this wild over the top aesthetic that they're going for, which, you know, is kind of implied in the title Fragpunk, right? It really is wildly inventive with the sort of visual feedback that you're given. For example, if you get a headshot on an enemy, not only does the head kind of pop and spurt blood and stuff, but there's a series of wild 2D animations that happen around it. Like, it's very hard to explain almost. Like a demon is leaping out and congratulating you from their neck stump. You know, it's like these little demon heads kind of roll and laugh and give you high fives because you did such a good job. And it's all in these kind of pastel neon splashes of color. I got to say, it's very satisfying. And it isn't gory per se. It's more like it's kind of this spray paint, street culture kind of aesthetic. It really is neat, and it's not something I've ever seen before. For that alone, it's like, well, that's an awesome differentiator right there, because this is already a crowded genre. It's only going to get more crowded, and these are the games that ask their audience to really commit, right? If you want to jump into a hero shooter, you got to pick your hero shooter and really, you know, progress in that one. And so there's going to be a lot of casualties, especially with as many as have been announced recently. So that's the first thought I had, was like, you know, as somebody who is not steeped in a hero shooter experience, I don't have a ton, and I'm not super well versed in that genre. I don't have a favorite. I'm not the guy who's going to be able to judge it on any deep level. I did think that the aesthetic alone hooked me. The aesthetic alone made me want to keep playing because it's just fun. It's just fun being in that. Now, the second thing, well, before I even get to the second thing, the other, I think, big differentiator with Fragpunk, as you may have gathered from its announcement trailer, is that you get these cards. They call them, what are they called? Scarred cards or something like that. I can't remember. They're cards that let you break the rules in certain ways. And before each round or before each match, your team gets to decide which cards you'll put into play. And the way you do that is by voting with points that you have acquired. It takes a certain number of points to unlock a specific card. You can contribute some points. Other members of your team can contribute some points. And if you get enough of them, that card unlocks and gets selected for that round or match. And the cards are cool. Evidently, there's over 70 of them in the game at this point. And they range from just goofy stuff like big head mode to, you know, you can res your teammate once per match, to, you know, damage multipliers, to, you know, just kind of crazy stuff. And again, the aesthetic around it, like your character holds these cards and then smashes them or breaks them apart, and there's cool visuals involved. But I also think it makes for matches that are wildly different from each other, even when you are on the same map that you've played, you know, umpteenth times. The matches themselves are different. And you can see, as you're sort of drafting these cards and voting on them, you can see what your opponents are putting into play. So you know, you can make sort of some strategic decisions as a team as to maybe what you want to try to put into play yourselves. So I think that's kind of a cool differentiator too. I don't know if that's going to catch on or if that's adds too much RNG for people to be really feel like it's a, you know, purely competitive game. I'm not going to be the one to be able to judge that, but I do think the cards as they play out in the course of the matches is pretty cool. Now, that brings me to the second thing that I came away thinking, having played Fragpunk, which is, how do people choose which one of these they want to play? Like, it's such a banal comment, you know, kind of uneducated comment, but I felt like there's a bunch of characters. They're all vibrant and colorful and cool looking. And there's the big guy with the big rocket launcher as his super. There's the tank girl who can have a remote controlled tank as her super. There's the healer person. There's the person who could make shields, and like, it's the same characters as we always see. And, you know, variations on themes, of course, not exactly the same, not cookie cutter, but it's kind of the same as in Valorant and as in Overwatch and as in, you know, the countless others of these. And I kind of don't know. I'm throwing this out as a question to you guys. I don't know how one even decides.
When you play one of these games, you don't have a dream the following night where the character introduces themselves to you and says, you're going to be playing me? Because that's what everyone else gets.
Well, I mean, I guess it's no different than any other genre where it's like, well, which open world adventure game do you want to play? The one that appeals to you on whatever criteria. So I sort of recognize that the question is dumb on a certain level. But also, it feels like these, more than most, aren't that different from a gameplay perspective. But maybe, you know, Danish, you've made fighting games. I guess you could say the same about fighting games.
Totally. I mean, yes, what it comes down to is the aesthetic, the characters, the feel of it, and then also the gameplay. Like, there's, from an outsider's perspective, you can boil it down to like, in fact, many, many years ago, I was playing, I don't know what I was playing, probably Uncharted or something like that, like Uncharted 2 back in the day. And my wife walks in and she's watching me play and she's like, boy, all these games are the same, aren't they? like, what do you mean? Well, you run around, you punch people, you shoot people, you jump. That's video games. Like, I guess when you boil it down, that is what it is. but then you kind of go one step further. It's like, okay, someone who's a fan of games, but then maybe doesn't play a certain genre. And then, you know, like all tactics games, all strategy games, all 4X games, all, you know, RTS is like, from an outsider's perspective. And to be clear, I am also kind of an outsider when it comes to competitive first person multiplayer shooters. I don't play that many of them. I'm not that good at it, et cetera. And so I'm also kind of like on the outside looking in, and I can't really judge because I don't really know the ins and outs, but I assume it's sort of like, so for example, the last game that I really got into in the genre was The Finals, which I thought was so fun. I loved it, but you know, it's dead game now, so who cares? So, Love that game. So fun. Great aesthetic. What I liked about it is the vibe of it, the sort of kind of Smash TV-esque vibe of it. Right. Really gorgeous destruction and graphics. And then the game modes were really fun. So it's just like it was a nice sort of combination of all those little things that came together, and I had a lot of fun playing that game. So I think that's kind of what it is. It's just like, just a combination of all those factors.
I think that's the answer, you know, and you're absolutely right. And I recognize that my question was kind of dumb on the face of it, because it's like, well, what, you know, role-playing game do you like, Jeff? Because you like the role-playing game. So yeah, you know, how do you choose? But it is the same thing. It's the specifics that matter. I don't know why this genre in particular feels even less different game to game, but I think it's just my particular ignorance.
Oh, that I was going to say, absolutely it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. It's just that I'm not the guy who plays these.
Yeah, you know? I could tell you, I would say the exact same thing about JRPGs. That's a genre that I don't play a lot of, and from the outside looking in, I cannot tell the difference between them. Like, honestly, if you put 10 different screenshots of 10 different JRPGs, they all look the same. I cannot tell them apart. Right. So, and it's ignorance, 100% ignorance. Yeah. I'm not saying that as a pejorative, because it's me. I'm the one who's ignorant about it. So, yeah.
Well, there you go. Fragpunk, for all that, for all of my own kind of, dumbness about it, made a good impression on me, playing it. I don't feel like I'm going to make it my lifestyle from now on, but I really enjoyed my time with it. I think aesthetically alone is really fun. And the cards are a cool take on this, adding a bit of variety and wackiness. And I was into that as well. Even as I was being murdered by everyone. So you go. The only other game, and I'll talk more about this next week, I'm sure, because I'll be playing a lot more of it. But the only other game I want to bring up is Riven. Riven came out this week. I'm playing it exclusively in VR, although you don't have to.
Is it PC VR or Quest? Or how are you? Okay.
In fact, I got a copy provided to me, and they asked me which I wanted. And I said, I want the Meta Quest 3 version. Which they sent me. And then immediately as I played it, I was like, I made a terrible mistake. And I purchased the PC version.
Oh, wow.
because you can play the PC version in VR and stream it using Steam Link to the mm-hmm. headset, which is a vastly superior visual experience, mm-hmm. as one would expect, because it's basically like playing the mobile version versus the desktop version. And I think, entirely competent, entirely playable, in Meta Quest 3 standalone, but I am in the position where I'm basically going to be playing this game a foot and a half from my PC anyway. So I may as well be streaming it to the headset, which is what I'm doing. And so I actually purchased this after having gotten it for free. So I played it in both, and I will say it is a dramatic, now granted, I have a beefy GPU. My PC is very high end, so your mileage may vary, but it is a dramatic visual improvement, the PC version. And of course, you can play this flat as well, and the game is gorgeous. If you're not familiar with Riven, this is a remake. This is not a remaster. This is a full remake, ground up remake of a classic PC puzzle adventure game from, the 90s.
It's the sequel to Myst, right?
Sequel to Myst, yeah.
Do you have to be caught up on all your Myst lore to just jump in?
Jump in. It is a only tangentially connected story. And it is, to call it a puzzle game, I guess, is accurate, but it's more of a figure out this environment game. It's more of like be in a place and explore that place, and then there's certain things you need to observe and do.
Is it escape roomy?
Yes. Okay. Before that, escape rooms were a thing,
right?
Right.
This was, but it came back out in the day that people were just trapped in rooms. Nobody had figured out that you could escape them.
Yeah, that was it. They were called die in a room games.
That's what life was. No. You just
yeah, exactly. You just perished in a room. No. I mean, even many escape rooms have like full on puzzles, and there's a few in these in Riven, but I think even less than Myst, it's more like figure out how this thing relates to this thing and what's that contraption kind of do. It's less like a real puzzle and more like there's this thing and it operates in this certain way. And if I can figure out how to operate it, it's going to let me go to a new place and unlock a thing. And the sense of discovery in Riven is really awesome, especially in VR and especially now, because in its, you know, old iteration, its old sort of primitive manifestation, it really was a series of sort of static things that would then change to another static thing. You know, that's just how games were.
It was
back
built
then.
On the PowerPoint engine.
Right. I mean, yes.
That's only right. Half a joke if you know the making of Myst. Yeah.
But, you know, they have completely remade this game to be a fully 3D environment that you walk around in and you manipulate stuff and you touch things and move stuff and you look over here and look over there and up and down. And the game is beautiful. The environments are really vibrant and cool and awesome textures and stuff. And, man, playing it in VR is so awesome because it really is a game about observing things. It's look at that. And there's so many puzzles where you're like looking through the eye hole of a thing and doing that in VR is so rad. And it's just, I mean, I find myself like closing one eye in my VR headset and looking through the periscope of something or whatever. I'll be talking more about Riven in coming weeks, but this is a fantastic version of a complete remake. Cyan Games has lovingly recreated this game. I have very little memory of playing Riven, honestly, because it's been decades, many decades since I played it. But I do remember the islands. You know, you're on these sort of interlocking islands, and the way that you move between them is so cool. And there's so many moments of like you flicked a thing and did a thing, and then a whole mechanism unlocks and opens before you, and you do a thing and you can go to a new place. And it's just very, very satisfying, particularly in VR. But I think even out of VR would be a fun experience if you're into thinky games like that. It is a little thinky, but it's more explore and figure it out, but explore and test and try. And does that do this? And oh, I see what they're. Oh, it's very, very cool. Highly recommend the remake of Riven, which just came out. All right, before we go, we're going to carve out a little bit of tabletop time.
Right now.
Rich, every time you show up on the show, you bring with you some awesome tabletop experience. Last time I bought that, I can't remember what it was called, the deck of cards that lets relate to your friends.
Social
Alchemist. Yes, I brought it to a dinner party recently. It was a big hit.
Excellent. I'm
so
excited.
What have you got for me this time?
Well, this time I have something really special in the form of a board game called Wolves. This is from the people who made the tabletop RPG Coyote and Crow. Are you familiar with this at all? Is this familiar?
I have heard of Coyote and Crow. I have never played it, but I have not heard of Wolves.
So Coyote and Crow is a really fascinating game that is made by an indigenous design team. And the idea of Coyote and Crow is that what if the colonialism of the world didn't happen, which is really fascinating. And then like one of the things that they point out in Coyote and Crow is like words like indigenous or native or Indian don't exist in that universe, which is which is really neat. So Wolves is a co-op board game, not a tabletop RPG, but it's set in that world. And essentially there are a bunch of different communities, and you have each community has access to a deck of cards that will have different resources in it. So like some communities will have more fish, some might have more corn, some might have more buffalo. And you need to survive this winter. And every turn, it's a co-op game, so everybody wins or loses together, in the sense that if any community cannot meet their needs by the end of the turn, that's it. You're done. So you have to, what you have to do is you're basically drawing these resources and trying to push your luck, because there's a certain way that you can, you know, if you draw too many of a certain type of card, your turn is done. So you could end up with a very small harvest as a result, and then you have to rely on the generosity of one of the other communities to get you through that particular month. And there's this fun other mechanic with it, in terms of like getting you're basically getting like renown and stuff for helping other communities. So there's a competitive game within it, where the community that does the best and like helps everyone the most is going to be will be like the main winner at the end. But for the most part, it's all just like on the co-op front. Like you're just trying to get everyone to survive, and it's really hard and really like just a fascinating game. And it's a real quick game too. If you're into like a co-op thing that can have five or six people with relatively simple rules, that everyone will quickly grok and then be able to just dig into and play right away with minimal stopping and starting. Wolves is a tremendous game. It's also a beautifully designed game. Much like the Coyote and Crow tabletop RPG is a gorgeous looking book, it's the same designers that do this board game. It feels good. Like the pieces in it, and the various cards, and the artwork is all very specific and stylized and well done. So yeah, I think if you're somebody who's looking for cooperative games in general, or wants a cooperative game that could have a little bit of a competitive edge behind the cooperation, Wolves is a tremendous pick. It's a easy to learn, challenging to actually play successfully, but just a whole lot of fun. And it has, there's parts of it, it's like a little like Settlers of Catan, but like with less of a screw the person over and more of a help the person out vibe, which is, I think, just people need more of that these days, I think, when you have your tabletop gaming experience. So yeah, I can't recommend Wolves enough. It's
really, this is cool,
really special.
I'm looking at it. Careful, because there's also a board game called The Wolves, which just came out in 2023.
Not the same thing.
Not the same thing.
Could be great. But I don't know. I've never played The Wolves.
Yeah. Wolves just available on Amazon. Looks awesome. And again, my wallet, not so happy.
That's what we're here for. If you want to Google this more easily, if you Google Wolves, Coyote and Crow, it'll come up with the correct one.
And Coyote and Crow leads you to their website, where it has all of their games as well. The coyoteandcrow.net is where they have, and it says our games. So you can order it directly from them as well. Really cool. I was not aware of this at all.
Yeah, this looks awesome.
Awesome. All right, man, what a fantastic episode. Loved having you guys on. Thank you so much, Rich Lovejoy. Thank you for being here again. Tell folks where they can follow you and all the cool stuff that you do online.
So I am on the Gamers with Jobs conference call podcast. You can find me there. I am the Harpo Marxist on most social medias. Twitter, Blue Sky, etc. And I'll have a piece coming out in gamecritics.com soon about just kind of a general rumination on Dragon Age, the Veilguard, and fandoms, and how to approach art in a healthy fashion, where you accept that not things might not necessarily be the same, but they could also open you up to new and better things.
Awesome.
So yeah, that's coming out soon. I could be out when this podcast drops tomorrow. It could be published, or it could be later in the week. I don't know. Everything's a mystery, but not so much of a mystery. Like, you kind of generally know what's going to happen. So that's where you can find me.
Awesome. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those, folks. Danish Syed, always wonderful to have you on the show as well. Thank you for being here, for filling in for Christian.
Yeah,
much appreciated. Tell folks so they can keep up with you and all the stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, I think the best way is probably on Twitter @_DanishSyed. If you want to check out PCGamer.com, we have a couple articles in the last few weeks about our new Bitreactor Star Wars game. So really exciting stuff there. But yeah. It's been awesome being here.
I cannot wait for that game. Very excited for that game. All right. Let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts. Hang on. Where did I go?
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Rich, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Yeah, and I'm sorry for your wallet again, Jeff, because I think this is going to be of interest to you. So I just read a book, Theater Kids, by John DeVore, who is a tremendous author. If you want a quick taste of John DeVore's writing, we had on Gamers with Jobs, Graham Rowett read a short piece he had called Son of Pong, which is a beautiful and hilarious story, and also like heartbreaking story of him reconciling with his father's death. His father loved The Legend of Zelda and games in general, and it's him trying to relate to his father and wrestling with his own stuff. It's a beautiful piece. You can listen to that right away. My parting gift, though, is his book Theater Kids, which is about the off-Broadway scene in New York City at a very specific time, like in the late 90s, early aughts, where John, it's kind of a memoir. John came to the city and had this struggles with his own addictions and personalities, and then also engaged in off-Broadway theater, including doing a 4-hour production of an adaptation of William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying in a tiny theater in Brooklyn before people really were willing to go to Brooklyn to see theater. And it's about the kind of just the bananas impulse to do these kind of experimental, crazy sounding shows that are actually like have this like beauty and heart behind them. And it's such a powerful book. It is, if you're somebody who's ever been a theater kid, I think you kind of have to read this. It's really beautiful and funny, and you will know so much about it like right away. Like John has a way of writing that is just, he has a way of turning phrases that is, I wouldn't say Douglas Adams-esque, but it's like he describes things in such a like a perfect way that like they hung in the air exactly the way bricks don't from Douglas Adams.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
John kind of has that kind of gift of like poetically being able to describe like very specific things through other things in that way. And it's just, yeah, I'm really taken. It's my favorite book of the year so far, Theater Kids. And part of that is probably my own nostalgia as a theater kid. And the fact that like reading this book for me, because I was in that scene a little bit afterwards was a lot like that Leonardo DiCaprio pointing meme for me. Like, oh my gosh, I know. That's so like that there's that level of it for me. But even without that, I think if you check out his The Son of Pong piece, you'll get an immediate taste for like how John writes and how it's just he's beautiful and funny at the same time. And it'll punch you in the stomach, but pat you on the back too. It's like very warm and real and human and just gorgeous. So love it. That's Theater Kids.
Theater Kids by John DeVore. It's this is my jam. I'm going to be definitely checking this one out. Danish, do you have a parting gift?
Yeah, I actually got another book. Pyrrha Nisi by Susanna Clarke. This is a pretty brisk novel, like 245 pages. I listened to the audiobook, which is like 5-6 hours. Like you can a couple workouts kind of power through it. And it's awesome. I haven't really read anything else like it because of the kind of structure of it, where you are thrown into this situation and you have no idea what's going on. You don't know what world you're in. You don't know the rules of this world. You don't know where you are. And all you have is this main character who's kind of figuring things out. And to be honest, it took a couple chapters of like, okay, I don't know what I'm really supposed to be getting from this yet. And then eventually start to like hook into a couple mysteries. And then that kind of starts to pull you along. And then about the halfway point is when you realize what's happening. And it's so cool. And where it goes from there is amazing. And what it has to say is amazing. And I almost don't want to even talk about the themes because in a way it might even be a spoiler for like what the book is doing. But I just thought it was an absolutely brilliant book and highly, highly recommended. A pretty quick read. That's Pyrrha Nisi by Susanna Clarke.
Well, you recommended this to me a while back and I am currently listening to the audiobook.
Yeah.
Chiwetel Ejiofor is the narrator. And it is a masterclass.
Yes, he is so good.
Incredible. Incredible. I'm a person that has done audiobooks. I'm a connoisseur of audiobooks. It is next level. And it's very slow reading. He takes his time. And at no point have I had an impulse to increase the speed because he's acting it. It's incredible. It's so good.
I want to say I think he won some awards for his performance too. I think it's,
I hope so.
It is really incredible.
It's such an amazing performance of this book that is, as you describe, delicious. That's the word I would use because it's just questions. You just get, you have so many questions.
Did you get to the halfway point?
I have gotten to the point where we met 16.
Okay.
Yeah. So I kind of know what's going on.
Yeah.
Ish.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's getting so crazy and awesome.
So good. Yeah.
Yes. So,
I have this book, but I haven't read it yet. And this sounds like I need to remedy that, or maybe just go ahead and buy the audiobook and take a hit to my wallet as like a little bit of
man, Audible just had a sale and that's when I bought it. They just had a huge sale, like site-wide sale. I would say it's worth the audiobook for this, but I'm sure reading it is delight as well. This is the first Susanna Clarke I've read. Mm-hmm, I know same. People are huge fans of her. The economy of language.
Yeah.
It's not the most flowery prose, but it's like precision.
Yeah.
It's like totally. She uses the exact very few words, but like bang for your buck on each. It's she's a very skillful writer.
Yeah, she's probably most famous for Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Yes. Which I know.
Tremendous. Yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah. Yes. Much longer than this.
Yes, like five times
it's
longer.
A tome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
1,000 pages.
But this is a very different stylistically, structurally, in every possible way. But
one last note. it was just announced that the rights to the movie were picked up by Laika Animation Studios.
Oh my god.
Which is amazing. They did Coraline, Kubo and the Two Strings. So
what an odd brilliant.
Yeah, it is odd and so inspired to do it this way. I'm so excited by it, but I also kind of don't know how they're going to take it, which way they're going to take it, because it gets really dark.
It gets super adult.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It is not. I mean, it starts in this kind of wondrous, fantastical place, and then it gets anyway. I echo that, and I'm grateful for your recommendation to me of that book. My parting gift is another Danish Syed recommendation.
I was so delighted to see this on the list. Oh my God.
It didn't start out as a Danish Syed recommendation. It started out as me watching two episodes of the show and piecing out hard. It's a show on Apple TV Plus called Dark Matter. Joel Edgerton is the star, Jennifer Connelly, the two stars. This is a science fiction show based on the Blake Crouch novel. I have not read the novel. I was super excited about this show because I like sci-fi. Watched the first two episodes, just thought it was tired and lazy and kind of, you know, was retreading a well-worn sci-fi trope that I just didn't think it was adding much to. Peaced out. Danish texted me and said, you got to stick with the show. It gets way better. And I was like, all right. Well, I'm very glad I did, because he was absolutely right. I have watched all 9 episodes now.
Oh my God. The last two.
Dude, the last two. Oh my God. So bonkers. Here's the thing about the show. And I've been meaning, I really wanted to have like
gotta,
a long
We got to go to, yeah, we got to get long in-depth conversations at some point. Yeah.
But I don't know if the show is like intentionally being kind of played out. You know, in the first two episodes, it's doing something that you've seen 1,000 times. Yeah. But I don't know if it like is intentionally doing that to swerve you into thinking.
I think it's for the normies. I think it's for people who don't know this stuff.
I guess.
And it's like an on-ramp for them.
It is a show where it's one of those shows that it's so annoying to tell people about, because you're like, you got to get through the first –
But I, honestly, if you're not super into this stuff, I don't think the first two will be a chore, because it's only a chore for us because it is tired, like you said. It's something we've seen before a million times, but I don't know if that applies to everyone, only for like hardcore sci-fi fans like us, you know?
That might be a good point. For me, I'm just like, do something fresh and interesting already. Well, it does. It very much does. It just takes a minute.
Yeah.
And the thing that I really wanted to ask you is like, there were many, many times where I almost texted you as I was watching. Like, because I had like, why isn't the show thinking about this and this?
Yeah.
And guess what? It is.
Yeah.
It just hasn't gotten to that yet.
Right.
I kept thinking I was ahead of it,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't. And that's one of the coolest feelings, is when you think like, well, but if this, then it has to this and this.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, it knows.
Right.
It just hasn't gotten there yet.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is a very satisfying sci-fi show. I think one of my favorite sci-fi shows in recent memory. It really, by the end, is just so smart and clever and detailed and like goes places. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, goes places. So highly recommend watching Dark Matter. Don't get dissuaded if the first couple episodes put you off like I did.
Two things I want to add. One is I've heard some people say that it is a little bit slow in the middle, and I don't disagree. But what I will say is I appreciated living in the moment of these things. Like it does some sci-fi things that we've seen before, but it's usually where the movie might end. And this show like really lives there. Like, how would it actually work on a human level to be going through this stuff? And I personally really did appreciate that. And the way, and it's really hard to talk about without spoiling it, but the way character arcs develop is very smartly written, where people, the way they diverge in their experiences and what that makes them into, how, the kind of people it makes them into, is all explored here and done really well. And the second thing I want to say, and this is sort of just just to hype up that the last couple episodes is the second to last episode happens. And I'm like, I don't know how this show can possibly end. I, like, it is setting up things that there's no way they can do this. There's no way they can make this satisfying. Yeah. There's way too many of these questions that I have. And I was sitting there thinking, like, well, what if they did this? What if they did that? No, that wouldn't be satisfying. That wouldn't be satisfying. How are they going to do this? And they did it. They did it by doing something I've literally never seen before in my life.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. And
it's awesome. And it also sets up for a killer season two if they get to it.
I think they did. I don't know if they announced, but I think they said they're working on it. I am skeptical because the first season was based on the first book, as far as I understand.
Yeah. Was there a second book? I don't even know.
I don't think there was. And also, I don't even know if it finished the book in the finale of the season was the finale. I don't actually know. But if it's going past the book, that's where I get a little worried. But I do know that the writer of the book was very heavily involved in the show. So maybe it'll be great.
It's awesome. It's really, really cool.
And, all right. You've sold me.
You're going to dig it, Rich.
I'm going to jump in for some Dark Matter.
Dark Matter on Apple TV Plus. All right. We do also have a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. And it was not signed, but here it goes. It says, "Hey there, just wanted to reach out as I'm a big fan of the podcast. I listen to it every morning on my commute. I'm reaching out to see if my website, guess the game, could be a parting gift. It's a daily puzzle game like Wordle, except instead of guessing a word, you try to guess a video game based on 6 screenshots. I have a feeling that a lot of your listeners would be interested in playing too. We even have players from some popular game developers and publishers like the team from Outer Wilds, Vampire Survivor, Dredge, etc. Thanks." Thank you, anonymous emailer on the team for Guess the Game. I checked this out. It's pretty clever. Pretty clever idea. And there you go. We love supporting folks that listen to the show and are doing creative stuff. So check out guessthe.game. It's a guessing game using screenshots from video games. And if you'd like to have your parting gift read on the show, send it to us, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. All right. That's going to do it for this marathon, fantastic episode of DLC. Thanks again to Rich Lovejoy and Danish Syed for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, that would be Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star. They did those awesome bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can get swag for the show, hats and t-shirts and stuff, at store.dlcpod.com. We do need to thank, our biggest thanks, honestly, go to our patrons who make this show possible at patreon.com/dlcpod. Without them, we wouldn't be here. We are very grateful for their support. If you'd like some cool perks, check out patreon.com/dlcpod. All right. Thanks again. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.